This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. At the United States Senate today, five volumes of 50-year-old transcripts were made public for the first time, transcripts of hearings before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953 and some in 1954. The chairman in those days was Senator Joseph McCarthy. His targets were Americans he suspected of communist subversion. His methods were so demagogic and abusive of human rights that McCarthyism became synonymous with modern-day witch-hunting and slander by insinuation. Two recent chairs of that same subcommittee, Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Democrat Carl Levin of Michigan, announced the formal release this morning.
I think it's always a useful reminder to those of us who head investigative subcommittees to be reminded of the excesses that occurred during the McCarthy period.
I think there's greater awareness of McCarthyism and what the tactics can be used by people who are trying to quiet dissenters. And there's greater resistance against those who would try to still voices that they disagree with.
The transcripts in question were of closed-door testimony, from which the press and the public were excluded. Donald Ritchie, the associate historian of the Senate, has worked on their release for the past 2 years.
These were sort of dress rehearsals in some respects, in which the senator was hearing what the witnesses were going to say, deciding which witnesses to call into public and which ones not to. About a third of all these witnesses never testify in public session. And then he would go and hold the public hearings. And we actually have many, many volumes of public hearings that this committee held. They were followed by the press. The early TV cameras came in to cover the hearings. But there were some 160 hearings that were held behind closed doors that were never released. There were transcripts. There were reporters of debate who copied down what was being said. But neither the senators nor the witnesses actually ever saw those transcripts.
And what emerges as different, or what amplifies the record about Senator McCarthy from these closed-door hearing transcripts?
Well, Senator McCarthy always told the witnesses at the end of these hearings that they could go and talk to the press if they wanted to, but he was not going to give the press their names, and they didn't have to talk to the press. Senator McCarthy would then step out into the hallway where the reporters were waiting, and he would tell them what went on in that session. And in many cases, what he told the press was grossly exaggerated, twisting the words of the witnesses. And those were the stories that got into the headlines in 1953 and 1954. A few days later, or sometimes a few weeks later, when he held a public hearing, the witness would get their chance to testify. But by then, the story had moved on, and in many cases, public opinion had pretty well formed that, yes, indeed, he had found some kind of subversion and espionage in this particular agency.
You drew my attention to a couple of very noteworthy witnesses. First, the composer Aaron Copland.
Senator McCarthy's committee was supposed to be looking into government subversion. Aaron Copland wasn't a government employee, but he had gone abroad as a Fulbright scholar to talk about American culture. And that was sufficient for Senator McCarthy then to call Aaron Copland in and to question him on his politics, not necessarily his politics in the 1950s, but his politics in the 1930s. And they had recorded all of the petitions that Aaron Copland had signed in the 1930s. And Copland signed copious petitions. And he was now at this point trying to explain to the senator that he was not a political person, he had never joined a political party, and that in most cases these were penny postcards that he signed for causes that seemed worthy at the time.
Yeah, there's a very interesting exchange that says a lot about how Senator McCarthy conducted himself and about the era in which Copeland protests that he wants to point out that, yes, he belonged to an organization or he did something for it in 1941, but he points out it wasn't put on the official list of un-American organizations until 1948. So when he belonged to it, it was not a listed organization. Here's how that exchange went.
Just for your information, the record shows that as far back as 1941, the program of the Fifth National Conference of the American Committee for Protection of Foreign Born named you as a sponsor. Later, a letterhead of the New York Committee for Protection of the Foreign Born on January 2, 1941, showed you as a sponsor, and later, in 1943, you were again listed as a sponsor. I might say that this organization has been cited by the Attorney General and by the House Un-American Activities Committee as one of the oldest auxiliaries of the Communist Party in the United States. Does that refresh your recollection?
May I point out that there is a notation here that was cited in 1948, which is, I believe, 7 years after the dates you just quoted.
Mr. Copeland, the date of citation is not important. It is no more important than the date a man was convicted of robbing a bank. The question that is important is whether or not you participated in robbing the bank, not whether another man participated in robbing the bank and was convicted. Any man with normal intelligence knows that it is wrong to rob a bank. Even before the citations, it is sometimes known that the organization is a communist front, a front for the Communist Party.
As far as I know,
I am not criticizing you for joining these organizations. You may have been so naive that you didn't know they were communist-controlled, or you may have done it purposely, but I can't believe this very long list used your name time after time as a sponsor of all these outstanding fronts. I can't believe that they forged your name to these petitions, borrowed your name unlawfully time after time. However, I am only interested in knowing why they selected you as a lecturer when we have so many other people available as lecturers.
That was a reading, of course. We don't have any recordings of what actually happened. And McCarthy is saying, even if when you belonged to an organization, it wasn't on any government list, ex post facto, it was still wrong for you to belong to that.
That's right. And, of course, times had changed dramatically, and that during the early 1940s, the Soviet Union was our ally during the war. And there were many American-Soviet friendship groups that, in fact, were sponsored by the government. There were groups that felt that it was entirely reasonable to belong to these things.
Now, was Copeland called back to testify in public, either in the Senate or the House?
No, the Senate did not call Aaron Copeland to testify in public. He's one of the many witnesses who only testified in private. And looking at the types of people that Senator McCarthy chose to call into the public session, those who stood up for themselves, who defended themselves rationally, who articulated their positions, he tended not to call them into public session.
Now, there is also a testimony given by the poet Langston Hughes. Again, someone who didn't testify in public?
No, Langston Hughes did testify again in public, but I found that his executive session testimony was, in fact, much more eloquent than his public testimony. One reason, perhaps, was that Senator McCarthy wasn't present on the day that he gave the executive session testimony. Senator Everett Dirksen was presiding that day. Senator Dirksen operated more in a traditional senatorial mode, and he allowed the witness to speak his mind. Even though the chief counsel, Roy Cohn, kept trying to interrupt, Cohn was more of a prosecutor and really didn't want to allow the witness, in a sense, to defend themselves. But Senator Dirksen gave Hughes a chance to explain himself. And Hughes goes back and gives a remarkably eloquent account of what it was like growing up as a young African-American in segregated America, why his politics were quite radical in the early 1930s, how he became disillusioned with the Soviet Union after visiting there, and how his early poetry and some of his early writing didn't reflect the way he thought in the 1950s. But there's a certain insidiousness to all of this, in that writers were being called in and questioned about books that they'd written a generation earlier, and in a sense asked to denounce their own writings, their own novels, their own poetry, which was pretty devastating, even for those who had changed their opinions and were quite willing to talk about it.
There's an exchange between Roy Cohn, who was the counsel to the committee, and Hughes over whether his work Scottsboro Limited reflected his thinking. We'll hear a reading now of some of that exchange.
It is your testimony. You were writing in character. And what was said did not represent your beliefs?
No, sir. You cannot say I don't believe, if I may clarify my feeling about creative writing, that when you make a character, a Klansman, for example, as I have in some of my poems, I do not, sir.
How about Scottsboro Limited, specifically? Do you believe in the message carried by that work?
I believe that some people did believe in it at the time.
Did you believe in it?
Did I?
Did you personally believe? You can answer that.
After this exchange, Roy Cohn reads from the piece in question in which Langston Hughes had written, this was, I guess, from back in the 30s, "Rise, workers, and fight. Audience, fight, 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 fight. The curtain is a great red flag rising to the strains of the Internationale." So there was a lot of old lefty writing from the 30s that people were being confronted with here 20 years later, I guess.
Surely, and yet, of course, we have a constitutional right to speak and to write and to sign petitions, and all of these were issues that people had felt that they had participated in, regardless of what the political background was.
Senator McCarthy is a very complicated figure in discussing the entire era, because in many ways he was the least successful in those terms, anti-communist in Washington. Many more people were ruined by a House committee or by the FBI, frankly, in those days.
One of the things that we discovered as we went through, we tried to find out what happened to each of the witnesses, and we discovered that no one who testified before McCarthy's committee ever went to jail for contempt of Congress or for perjury, even though he threatened them quite frequently. And, of course, he was doing these hearings at the same time that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were being executed, so this was no idle threat on his part. These witnesses were quite frightened that they could spend time in prison.
I want to ask you a question as a Senate historian, as a historian of the U.S. Senate. So perhaps I'm asking you to talk about the institution that employs you. But you read Senator McCarthy as an aberration. Do you read him as somebody who could possibly thrive again today, or something has changed about the institution that prevents him from having a ride like this in, say, the 21st century?
If we can say that anything good came out of the McCarthy hearings, McCarthy so pushed the envelope that the Senate pulled back and actually changed the rules in which congressional investigations are held. Even McCarthy's own committee, the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which still exists and which has released these records today, changed its rules to prevent the kind of treatment of witnesses and the kind of one-man show that McCarthy would set up by holding hearings abruptly out of town without notifying the other senators, by subpoenaing people at 9 o'clock at night to appear at 9 o'clock the next morning. A lot of tactics that we just do not permit there. And then in 1957, in June of 1957, the Supreme Court handed down three major rulings in which they essentially affirmed the rights of all witnesses who appear before congressional investigations.
Of course, we will get 17 emails saying that grilling Aaron Copland about what committee he expressed support for 10 years earlier is exactly what's happening to people who supported some American Muslim committee some years ago, and now they're being called to account for that in some other government forum.
The question of national security versus civil liberties is a very old one. It goes back to the Alien and Sedition Acts, and it's right up to the present day. And this is an important part of that story and deciding, you know, what compromises need to be made under those circumstances.
Mr. Ritchie, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Donald Ritchie, Associate Historian of the United States Senate, on today's release of 5 volumes of transcripts of closed-door testimony from the McCarthy era. You can access the transcripts online from a link at our website, npr.org.